This is KUT 90.5. I'm Nathan Bernier. The Texas State Board of Education today voted 14-0 to reject a Mexican-American history textbook that scholars have said was riddled with inaccuracies, hundreds of them. Trinidad Gonzalez is a professor of history at South Texas College.
One of the fundamental problems with the scholarship of the book is that you have non-historians writing a textbook for history. It's really a polemic masquerading as a textbook. And it's really trying to argue that Mexican-American culture, including Catholicism, is a fundamental threat to American democracy.
But this is not the first time that non-historians have written a textbook for Texas classrooms. I'm holding in my hands right now a seventh grade history textbook published in 1954. It was written by two middle school principals, one from Marshall, Texas, and one from San Antonio. In the acknowledgments at the front, you can find the book's guiding philosophy.
In broad strokes, it paints the romantic story of our state from the coming of the white man to the present. All the essentials are here, while the minor details that mar rather than enhance so glorious a picture are purposely omitted. Here, one will find all the heroic deeds of Texas heroes told in dramatic style that will thrill boys and girls and give them a greater appreciation and love of the traditions and documents that are the heritage of the present generation.
Preserving orthodox notions of gender and faith and nation, and to have been aware of the participation and contributions of groups other than Anglo males was just not in the cards educationally during the 1950s.
Dr. Nancy Baker Jones is with the Ruth Weingarten Foundation for Texas Women's History. She's one of several experts in Texas history we asked to review this 1954 textbook. Jones says one of the most obvious aspects of women's history in Texas is the suffrage movement, when women fought for the right to vote, but it's not mentioned in the book. Instead, women are defined by their relationship with men.
The great state of Texas has only been brought about through the toil and sacrifices of our forefathers, those men who fought and died so we can have the comforts and freedom that we enjoy today. Of course, we must never forget those brave women, the wives and mothers who endured the hardships of the frontier to help the men carve out an empire of civilization amid the wilderness.
So what you have set up here is this mythology. The women who helped these brave men were wives and mothers. They were connected to men through marriage and motherhood. They were not single women. They were not working women. They were not reformers. They were the women who were in their socially approved places, to the exclusion of many other roles that women have played and contributions that women have made and lives that women have lived.
This textbook was used by public school students across Texas in the late 1950s and early 1960s, so it helped shape the perceptions and attitudes of people who today would likely be in their 60s. Okay, now let's hear from another historian who looked at this book for us.
These are the two things that jumped out at me.
Sam W. Haynes is a history professor at the University of Texas at Arlington and is the director of the Center for Greater Southwestern Studies.
First of all, the illustrations for the book, particularly the photographs, which are taken from B-movies and films about Texas history from the 1940s and 1950s.
Happy dreams.
Hold it, you two!
Struck me as rather odd, a peculiar blending of popular culture and history. That was the first thing. The second thing was the textbook characterizes Texas history as a clash of cultures, which isn't surprising because that's the sort of the traditional narrative of Texas history. And there really isn't a sense that Texas is one of the most diverse regions in North America in the first half of the 19th century.
Native Americans were the largest ethnic group in Texas until about 1830. They're mentioned in this textbook from 1954, sometimes as savages, although the textbook says most tribes were small and played no important part in the history of our state.
The Comanches were one of the largest groups of Indians in Texas, numbering about 7,000. They were of a warlike nature and were superb horsemen. They had frequent clashes with the Spanish and later with the early Anglo-American settlers. You may remember that when the Spanish built a mission for the Apache Indians on the San Saba River in Maynard County in 1757, 2,000 howling Comanches and their allies came riding down on the little settlement and butchered the inhabitants.
Well, I think just referring to any Indian tribe as howling, I guess you could say that the language reinforces the films that are used as illustrations. They all sort of tend to perpetuate this narrative of Anglo-Saxon civilization and Native American savagery.
The authors of this 1950s Texas history textbook sought to make the Anglo-American stand out as even more heroic and upstanding than was perhaps necessary. What the Texans were doing was certainly worthy of attention, even if you didn't agree with it. But listen to this excerpt of the textbook that was singled out by another historian. It deals with the siege at the Alamo.
There was no regular standing army in Texas. All were volunteers who left their homes at their country's call, whatever guns and ammunition they could lay their hands on. Most of them had old-fashioned muzzle-loading rifles or shotguns that they used for hunting.
My name is Jesus Francisco de la Teja, and I am Regents Professor of History and Jerome and Catherine Supple Professor of Southwestern Studies at Texas State University. And of course, even in 1954, people knew that the Mexicans weren't any better armed than the Americans, and in fact, the Brown Bess, which is what many of the Mexican soldiers were using, were actually antiquated surplus Napoleonic war weapons that was all that Mexico could afford at the time. Many of these Anglo-Americans came with American rifles that, although the main purpose may have been hunting, were also used in Indian defense and were really quite powerful weapons. And of course, today we know even more. From a technical point of view, the Anglo-Americans, as far as small arms are concerned, were much better equipped than the Mexican army. So those are the kinds of problems that crop up. Some of them are understandable in terms of the state of knowledge in the mid-1950s. Some of them are efforts to paint the story as much in favor of Anglo-Americans as possible, and others are just, I don't know where they possibly could have gotten that.
Boys, Santa Ana has just crossed the Rio Grande with an army. Now, the war isn't over yet. It's just begun, and we're Texas's only army. Are we going to fight?
Yeah!
Walter Binger is a professor in the history department at Texas A&M University. He read a chapter for us in this 1954 Texas history textbook called The War Between the States.
The War Between the States, yes. That's a definite tip-off that this book has a Southern point of view.
Lincoln was elected president of the United States in the fall election of 1860. The South was challenged. Slavery might be abolished at any moment now, the Southerners thought. The Southern planters expected that they would be ruined. What should they do? Should the Southern states remain in the Union at the risk of losing their power to the fast-growing North? The election of Lincoln fanned to a blaze the burning question of states' rights. Should the states surrender their rights to the federal government?
Historians after the late 50s went back and actually looked at what people said at the time. And what they said at the time in the late 1850s and early 1860s was that secession was about a defense of slavery. It's fairly clear that slavery caused the Civil War.
The textbook acknowledges that slavery at least played a role in the Civil War, but it also treats African Americans as subhumans, and again only defines their history in terms of the convenience of slavery to Anglo-white property owners. And then there's the chapter on what happened after the Civil War.
I am Benjamin Johnson. I am an associate professor of history at Loyola University Chicago. Probably the most difficult to swallow thing for me is its description of Reconstruction, right? Where it basically says,
most of the Ku Klux Klan members who operated in Texas between 1867 and 1869 lived in East Texas. At that time, some greedy politicians were trying to use the Negro vote to their own advantage. These dishonest politicians included men from the northern states who came to Texas to get government offices during the Reconstruction period. The Southerners called them carpetbaggers, saying that they came to the South with nothing except what they carried in a cheap bag made of carpet. There were also, unfortunately, some Southerners who were willing to join with the carpetbaggers and Negroes to obtain government positions. They were called scalawags. Naturally, these men were despised by all Southerners, who realized that they did not represent the majority of the people. The laws were often disregarded and crimes became common.
For those of us who know about the horrors of Jim Crow, that's really awful that that was in the textbook. On the other hand, that was not just the reigning consensus in a middle school Texas history textbook. That was the reigning consensus in the 1950s in the Northern and Midwestern dominated college history professoriate. That's the way Reconstruction was written about.
We taught a whole generation to think of African Americans after slavery as children who were easily misled, and that translates into modern day. So if you think the past and the study of the past is disconnected from the present, you're wrong. How you conceive of the past often influences how you think in the present.
And there are people who are coming to Texas history who at home or in their communities know that the story that is presented officially is not the experience that they and their group had.
And those who are left out of that story are left to fend for themselves and to either reform it, to challenge it, or to recreate it and rewrite it in a way that includes them and includes their story.
I happen to know someone who used this 1954 Texas history textbook when she was in seventh grade. She's the person I borrowed it from, my mother-in-law, Maria Garza Lubeck. She's a ninth generation Tejana who studied history on the way to her PhD. And I asked her if the compelling narrative style thrilled her as a girl, as the authors promised, when she was reading it in middle school in San Antonio.
Absolutely not. It was dull and it was boring. I didn't belong. People that I knew didn't belong. I wondered about that, even though I'm a history major. My history, my people, which is Mexican American, and I'm also part Native American, so that goes even further. But there was nothing really there for me to learn about, to celebrate, to understand.
Texas history textbooks used by seventh graders today have improved by leaps and bounds. Of course, they now include more sober discussions of the Civil War, the women's suffrage movement, slavery, and civil rights. Not everyone would say they're perfect. School districts have more leeway now to choose their own materials, and they're not required to use everything adopted at the state level. But this textbook from 1954 is a reminder that in the grand sweep of history, some critical self-reflection and a broader narrative scope can go a long way to improving how engaged children are in learning about where they're from and where they're headed. Nathan Bernier, KUT News.